coming. So I will be talking about creative nonfiction, and well, we know now how diverse digital humanities are, right? And so I will be approaching creative nonfiction specifically from a quantitative corpus linguistic perspective. And thank you, Gavin, for the introduction into corpus linguistics for the audience today, so I don't have to do that. Okay, well, when I thought about the theme for this training day, right, fictional texts and real-world contexts, this study immediately came to mind. I did it a while ago, and I thought, well, that's exactly what creative nonfiction is. So that's why we're going to start with this question. Well, what is this domain, really? It's got this catchy name, creative nonfiction. It's got its own abbreviation, CNF. So when we look at how it's defined, we mainly get the writer's perspective. So they say, it's a literary genre. But then they immediately add, it's the fourth genre, so it doesn't fit into any of the existing ones, poetry, fiction, drama, so it's the fourth genre alongside those. The goal is to tell true stories, and this word true is really important for them, right? That's the nonfiction component, and that's because the stories have to be factually accurate. But then the stories can be told through a literary lens, so with attention to literary technique, and that's the creative part of the term, right? So that means that there's attention to character development and point of view and narrative arc, right? So these literary devices used in creative writing. And so writers talk about an immense amount of freedom and flexibility that this gives them, right? As they draw on their memories, their experiences, observations, opinions of the real world happenings. And so in this way, the genre really invites them to push boundaries. And so this freedom basically resulted in creative nonfiction becoming an umbrella term for a wide, wide range of different types of texts, right? So here we have memoirs, all kinds of essays, such as personal, lyric, speculative, meditative, collage, braided, you name it, any kind of essay can happen under this creative nonfiction umbrella. And then, well, writers end up saying, well, creative nonfiction can really mean anything and everything, right? To different things to different people. And that's exactly the characteristic that makes it so elusive, but also so alluring. Okay, well, to summarize all that, well, some parts of this can be really informative, but others not so much, because we see that there's little agreement on what CNF actually is, right? Because of how broad it is and because it's still evolving. And yet, it's gained a lot of traction, at least in the American context where this study was done. We see major social issues being presented through the lens of creative nonfiction. Acclaimed writers and literary journals apply the term to their published works. The classes in creative nonfiction in creative writing graduate programs at universities, right? So the medium and the term have gained a lot of traction. But as a linguist, what you would notice is that all of these descriptions come from a rhetorical or literary perspective, right? So we're learning from the writers themselves what it is that they produce, but there is no linguistic account of this register or genre or text variety, whatever term you want to use. And a linguistic account would mean a focus on the specific linguistic features, specific linguistic characteristics of these texts, right? So how do what are these texts actually comprised of, right? How do writers create these texts? And that was my motivation here. So what does this emerging register look like linguistically? What linguistic resources do the writers have at their disposal as they create these works? How do writers vary with respect to their use of these linguistic devices? And even why do they vary when they do? So I compiled a corpus of what I call modern creative nonfiction. That's because we have essays here of late 20th century, but then most of them of the 21st century. And so at the time I was actually doing some writing myself, I was taking a creative nonfiction workshop led by Lawrence Lenhart, one of my essays here. And so he was the one who directed me to these literary journals, digital literary journals, where I could find those essays and sample them. And so Essay Daily, the New York Review, right, digital platforms like these. And I compiled a corpus of 300 essays. It's not a huge corpus, you can see, but it was enough for my purposes. And I chose to do multidimensional analysis. So I'll say a few words about this method that gives insights into linguistic variation in the domain. I won't get into its technicality a lot, right? But I will demonstrate how it works in a minute. So multidimensional analysis identifies these general underlying patterns in discourse, and we call them dimensions of variation in discourse. These dimensions are based on linguistic feature co-occurrence. So it's about how features occur together in text to construct a certain type of discourse, right? And so the way this is done is that your texts are tagged automatically with the help of a computer program called a lexicogrammatical tagger. So these features are identified in your text, then their normed rates of occurrence are counted, are recorded, and so you have that information for each one of your texts. And then it usually starts with a broad range of linguistic features, right? But then you decide on the features that you want to focus on based on your domain. So linguistic features that you deem to be interesting, to be important or informative for the types of text that you work with, you select those and you include those into your analysis. And then some guidelines that come from statistics literature, right? This has to do with power for the statistical analysis here. 5 observations per variable, which for me meant that because I had 300 texts in the corpus, and I needed to have 5 texts per linguistic feature. So I could work with 60 features that I think are important for these essays. Okay, well, then you subject your texts and these feature counts to a procedure called factor analysis. And it's exactly this statistical procedure that's going to identify these underlying patterns of linguistic variation in your text, right? Essentially, it's going to look at a correlation matrix, so how these features correlate, right? So it's going to find texts where these features occur together, and then texts where this set of features doesn't happen so much. Then you look at these patterns and you interpret these feature co-occurrence patterns functionally. So you ask the question, what do these features really do in my texts, right? What's the function that they perform? Okay, to make this a little bit more concrete, let's look at one of my dimensions. So a dimension is a cline from one set of features to another. We call them positive and negative. So the two sets of features are in complementary distribution. When the positive features happen a lot in text to construct a certain type of discourse, negative features are relatively infrequent, right? And vice versa. So when the negative features work together to construct some kind of discourse, then the positive features happen relatively rarely, okay? So just take a minute to skim through those features. So in the positive end, we have first and second person pronouns. Then we have some indefinite and demonstrative pronouns, so these pronominal features on the one hand. We also have some verbs, right? That deletion, private verbs, public verbs, some verbal features, some adverbial features, such as emphatics and hedges, right? So characteristics of the verbs. Okay, on the negative end now, we have some nominal features. Attributive adjectives, prepositional phrases, right? Prepositions are usually associated with nouns. Nominalizations, these complex nouns, bipassives. Well, your next step is then looking at these features in context, of course, right? Because by themselves, this is, well, they're only informative to a certain extent. So each text receives a dimension score, okay? So you are able to now plot each of your texts alongside the along the dimension, right? That's the y-axis. And so the box plots here represent the spread of text scores for each of my authors. And the red square in the middle is the average of those text scores, the mean, all right? So a text that happens up here, for example, and you can see that it has a high positive score, has a lot of positive features, and those are bolded here. And the negative features are present, they're underlined, but compared to the positive features, well, they're not that frequent, right? And so when we look at a text like that and we see how these positive features work together, we understand what kind of discourse is created through that set of features. Then on the other extreme, this is a text with a low negative score. The negative features are underlined, and you see that barely any positive features are present. Okay, well, now that we've looked at these features in context, we can offer or propose some interpretive label for the dimension, right? So for me, this contrast here had to do with interactivity and involvement on the one hand, and informational focus or informational style on the other hand, because these nominal features here, they are associated with information density, right? Nominal structures, this is how we package information. They're really economical. And then verbal structures, pronouns and adverbs, as we said, on the positive end, that's interactivity and involvement. It's not just me interpreting this. There's been other research before this, of course, that reached these same conclusions. All right, well, so this study identified four such dimensions. So a contrast between interactive and informational style, then abstract expository versus concrete descriptive style, immediate versus removed style. This had to do with the temporal focus, so immediacy, present orientedness versus past orientedness and narration. And because the reader was removed from the narrative, right, or the narrator, it felt like the narrator was removed from the reader or the listener. That's why I chose this label. And so in this talk, I'll focus, and hypothetical style, but in this talk, I'll only focus on the first three dimensions. So what can we do? How do we compare the authors, right, or how do we analyze authorial style along these dimensions? So as I said, there are means plotted for each of my authors, right? The average across each author's text. There are also standard deviations. We'll come back to them later. So standard deviation shows variance across text, right? How far removed my individual data points are from the mean. So we notice that here, Gutkind and Hawkins are the two authors that form the most striking contrast, right? And we're talking only about the averages here. So for Hawkins, all of his texts, on average, much higher than the other author's texts on the dimension, right? So the mean is higher than the other means. That means that generally this author gravitates towards the positive range of the dimension, right, towards interactivity. And then Gutkind, again, generally, right, we do see a spread, but we're talking about some general preferences here, the central trend. Generally, this author gravitates towards the negative range of the dimension. And so we look at some text examples. So this is a text from Gutkind. This is a text from Hawkins. And so what we notice is dense use of negative nominal features in Gutkind's prose, prepositional phrases, nominalizations, attributive adjectives. And this is actually something that Gutkind has identified himself about CNF. So when this writer talked about what the genre is for him, he said, well, the goal is to communicate information, just like a reporter. And a writer's role here is to be engaged in the world, confident and informed. So we don't know whether this writer is doing this intentionally or not, but we do see alignment between our linguistic results, right, the types of features that this writer is using, and how he conceptualizes CNF, right, what he believes the goal is. And then on the other hand, Hawkins, consistent use of first-person pronouns, private verbs, frequent emphatics, right? So interactive and involved discourse. And again, we're talking about generally trends for this author's text. Second dimension, abstract expository versus concrete descriptive style. So you notice abstract nouns on the positive end, so they are responsible for the abstract part of the label. But then these verb complement clauses, this is what this is how exposition happens, right? Reasoning, explanation happens through those verb complement clauses. On the negative extreme, concrete nouns, these ing and ed participial structures, they are the ones that in this kind of discourse create concreteness. Okay, so again, to look at some author contrasts, we notice that Steinberg and Tavis are the writers whose texts are exclusively in the positive and in the negative range, respectively, right? All of their texts actually happen in different dimension ranges. We'll look at the texts, and we clearly see, well, prevalence of negative features here, description in Tavis' writing, and then lots of abstract expository features in Steinberg's text. So abundance of concrete nouns, what this does in Tavis' text is, well, they denote objects and places, right? It creates a highly descriptive, highly vivid, concrete text. But then in contrast, Steinberg here talks about the writing process, analytical thinking, the audience's thoughts and feelings. So features of stance, right? Verb complement clauses accomplish this function. And so journalists who have analyzed Steinberg's writing have actually said, well, there's this emphasis on exposition and reasoning, right? So again, similar conclusions have been reached in other fields and other by other scholars who work in very different, very different research traditions, right? But we call this triangulation. It's always nice to see similar conclusions reached by, well, through other methods, right? So they've talked about this author's preoccupation with the inner narrative, reflection, self-analysis, right? Things like these. Okay, so the third dimension, immediate versus removed style, as I said, has to do with different temporal orientation. Hawkins and Wallace here form a pretty striking contrast. We look at some text examples again. And so we see that for Hawkins, there's this focus on the past events. So the narrator here reminisces about the past events. They're very rare and very sudden switches to the present. So they're there, but and quite rarely. And what these asides, what these switches do is they have this effect of an aside where the reader is pulled in very briefly. So the writer here says, there's a succession of events. I screamed, but that's what you're supposed to do, right? And then they go back to the narrative, right? So it's this rapid switch, but really the overwhelming focus is on the past. For Wallace, there is a pervasive use of present tense. And when we start analyzing the feature in his writing, there's a focus on the internal experience. And literary critics have picked up on that. So Langer talks about this pure present expression of timelessness. So they say, well, when it comes to contemplation and emotion, time is not relevant. So there is this timeless present, in their words. And speaking specifically about Wallace's writing, Seguin said, the voices in Wallace are the very mark of a kind of unique inwardness or subjective style. So we wouldn't normally associate the present tense with subjectivity or inwardness, right? But when we get this prevalence, right? So the technique has shown us that the feature is so prevalent and we start analyzing it and turns out that this effect that the literary critics have identified is actually achieved to a large extent through that particular feature. Okay, well, so one thing we've done is we've compared authors, right, on each of the dimensions. We've looked at some noticeable contrasts, but we focused on the general tendencies, right, on the means only. What if our question is a particular person's style, right? So we want to describe a certain individual's use of language. Well, so the way to do this in this approach is in multidimensional space. And that's because each dimension adds something to this description, right? So they're interrelated, but they're distinct, they're unique, and they tell us something new about language use. So if we chose a particular person, then we would want to say something about their language use with respect to each of these dimensions. So I picked just a couple of names. They're kind of big names in creative nonfiction. So here we have Adichie's style on the three dimensions. So a balance of interactive and informational text on dimension one, markedly abstract style on dimension two. Each is characterized through different features, right? That's why we're saying that they're distinct. And whole dimension range from removed style to quite immediate on dimension three. This is David Foster Wallace, generally informational on dimension one, a balance of abstractedness and concreteness on dimension two, highly immediate style on dimension three. Sometimes there's this nice consistency. So Joe and Didion here, generally informational, generally abstract, generally removed, right? So, but again, says something about this person, right? Something they do consistently in their works. Okay, and one other thing that we can do, we can even go a step further and look within a particular writer, right? So what this visual here shows is that there's variation across each person's works, right? So far we've talked about general tendencies again, but we said that standard deviations are really important, right? They focus us on the, not on the mean, but on the spread of scores. And so this is what's highlighted here. That's actually the case for most of my authors. So I selected one author on each dimension, who showed the most variation. And so Philip Lopez here on dimension one, again, people have seen this, right? I have talked about this tendency of low-paid to be lively and engaged on the one hand, but then also attribute importance to density of thought, right? And so this versatility has been talked about. What we see is the linguistic evidence of that. All right, but my question was, what's the basis for this linguistic variation within a single person? Could it be that this linguistic variation is explained through some communicative reason? And so I focused on a communicative parameter, so I selected communicative purpose, and I read the essays, and I coded each essay for their communicative, for its communicative purpose. Okay, so I identified purpose groups within this author's, or across these this author's works. Address a question, describe a person, narrate and reflect, review and speculate. So this is meant to show that all of these purpose groups happen within Lopate's works, right? Okay, so what I saw was that there were actually statistically significant differences between among these purpose groups. So this meant that the differences in these purpose groups predicted language use on the dimension. So different purpose groups, different essays, depending on their purpose, use the language on the dimensions, on this first dimension differently. And so I identified this communicative basis for the linguistic variation across his text this way. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on these texts, but you can see just by looking at the highlights, right, the balance shifts, right? So this essay up there, describe a person, is more involved and interactive. Then we get addressing a question, right, where some features of information density start creeping in, and then review is the most informational. So I did the same for David Shields on immediate versus removed style dimension. These are the purpose groups, analyze and reflect, argue a point, narrate and review. Again, statistically significant differences among the groups, which meant that the language is used differently depending on what the communicative purpose of the text is. So analyze and reflect, markedly present-oriented. Then arguing a point, some features of past orientation. And then, of course, narrate expectedly uses features of narration, right? Okay, well, the picture is a bit more complex, but maybe a bit more interesting for Ander Monson on abstract expository versus concrete descriptive style. I did the exact same thing, but I also saw, as I was reading these essays, that regardless of which group I put them in, they all had a massive amount of reflection. So they were essentially doing the same thing. Every single type of text had reflection in it. And so then I didn't see differences in terms of the language that they used. So purpose didn't predict linguistic variation here. And that was not surprising to me because, well, I knew at that point that reflection was everywhere. But so what I did then, I used cluster analysis. So this bottom-up way, again, involving an automatic technique, to tell me maybe there's a different basis or a different way to group text, right, that I wasn't seeing as a human analyst. So cluster analysis groups these texts that are close in their linguistic dimensions course. And then I went in asking the question, well, okay, so these three clusters that it gave me, why are they distinct, right? So what is the basis there? They really are different. We can see here in this plot. And turns out that for Ander Monson, variation on this dimension has to do with the degree of reliance on concrete illustration, or rather the types of examples that this author uses. So we would need to read more of the text, but basically some texts use very concrete illustrations, right? Again, through specific objects, right? That type of examples. But then other texts prove their point through a discussion, right, that somehow illustrates their, or drives the message home, okay? So, yeah, very different strategies in terms of how argumentation happens, right, or what kind of examples this author uses, and that results in variation on this dimension. Okay, well, zooming out, and just to ask, what did we see here, and really, who is this work for, and what can we do with this? So we saw linguistic descriptions of a discourse domain, right, or a linguistic account of a discourse domain, and this can be done in any domain at all. And this linguistic description was done through, or by focusing on general patterns of linguistic variation, right? Dimensions based on feature co-occurrence rather than some specific linguistic feature. We looked at author differences first in the use of language, right, on those dimensions. We then said that if we're interested in a particular person's style, then we could analyze their style in multidimensional space, so with respect to the features of each of these dimensions. And then we can go further, we can look at intra-author variation, and in my study specifically turned out that this variation was due to communicative reasons. Well, so who is this for, or is there use for this beyond these studies? Well, of course, this is for researchers who care about stylistics, right? Computational stylistics. They have talked about complex interplay of stylistic features as opposed to choosing some specific features as predictors of authorship, for example. So they actually say that a complex interplay of stylistic features, well, first we should acknowledge that that linguistic features don't happen independently of each other, right? So they actually co-occur rather than, well, one feature at a time. But they actually point out to a greater predictive power of a set of features. So people who do authorship attribution, authorship recognition. So they say, well, if we look at several features at a time, right, then that's going to be more powerful, more informative when we tell authors apart, right, when we're trying to automatically identify that. Then people have talked about selectiveness of stylistic analysis, right, and that's based on intuition. Often we decide, well, what features are we going to look at when we're going to compare authors? I guess Stan's features are interesting, right, but that's our decision. So this method actually resolves that problem, right, because it identifies the features that are important for the discourse domain, and then we work with whatever we know already is important for the discourse domain. All right, but going beyond research, of course, maybe more real-world applications. So this matters, or should matter, hopefully, to writers, to teachers of creative writing, to translators, so people who actually create, produce these texts, right, or any kinds of other texts, right, that people learn to write. So it gives us an insight into the specific linguistic means that comprise a certain type of discourse, right? So if you want to achieve a certain effect, right, then these are the features that do that, and this is how they work together. Well, and then I thought, well, how about readers? How about end users of digital platforms? So all of us, and digital humanists, right? So does this, is this relevant for these other disciplines, right? These other research traditions? Well, maybe we're going to start asking questions such as, well, really, what is the fiction nonfiction interplay there, right? Because, well, these essays in large part exist on digital platforms, right? But we could ask that same question about any other digital domain. What kind of language do we produce and receive on digital platforms because of how varied their affordances are? Well, the language is similarly just as varied, right? So the language actually reflects the variety of those affordances. And how does that language vary and why, right? So what's the basis for that variation? Some references, and thank you so much.